Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Mark Wahlberg. Not you, not you, and not you, Mark Wahlberg. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. You're listening to a very special episode today. It's a celebration here. We've got streamers, we've got confetti, there's a cake in the corner. It is our 50th episode.
Woo!
Yeah, yeah, welcome.
Welcome. It's also almost our one-year anniversary.
Passed our one-year anniversary, yeah.
It's called a birthday, not an anniversary.
Whatever, I don't know.
And, like, it's kind of the opposite of a human's first birthday is what I was thinking. And here's why.
Okay.
Have you ever been to, like, a one-year-old's birthday party when they just turn one?
I've been to mine, and probably my sister's.
Okay. But not as a grown-up. No. You've never been to, like, a child's birthday?
People know I hate babies now.
So here's the deal when you go to a one-year-old's birthday. Yeah. Everybody else cares.
Uh-huh. Except.
And the baby doesn't understand. Now with us, we care, but nobody else cares.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that might be the most correct thing you've ever said on the podcast.
And that is how this is kind of the opposite of a normal birthday.
Yeah. Nice. Well, hooray for us.
Yeah, right? Stuck to it anyway.
Yeah. Any of the non-listeners that are paying attention to this?
Yeah. Actually, I guess we should give a shout out to people who actually do.
Yeah, listen. Yeah. Thank you for listening. We spend a lot of time on this, and we like to think that people listen.
Matt Wiles sends us emails.
Yes, he does.
Comments.
Yeah.
Go, Matt.
Yeah.
Claudian as well.
Yeah.
And the Chalister.
Yeah. Chalister loves us.
Yeah, he does. Mm. So thank you guys especially. Thanks to everybody. But it makes us feel important when you email us.
Yeah.
Which those people do.
Yeah, because
so thank you.
If we didn't get any feedback from anybody, we would probably stop. But now we know, like,
but since we got 8 emails in a year.
That's enough. That's enough for me to watch movies and be like, talk for 4 hours with David Fincher.
So there's that. Mm. What do you got?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just...
You want activity?
Yeah, obviously.
It's a TV activity.
Yeah. Okay.
What?
Well, I guess we're going to explain the idea.
Yeah, sorry, so much champagne at the, at the 50th party.
I can't wait for that cake.
More champagne.
I've been starving
more
myself.
Toast is...
I've been starving myself all day for this cake. So, yeah, the idea of our 50th is that, for reasons that I think we'll explain shortly, we sort of wanted to look back on things that we actually liked that we said. some things we don't agree with anymore. Well, I guess I'm explaining it now. Like, in listening back for things that I actually liked, because once I edit these podcasts, I never listened to them again, except for when we had this idea to put together our best, like a best of type of thing, like things we still agree with.
And, like a clip show.
Yeah, exactly. And I found that listening to some of our old podcasts, like, you know, not entire things that I just vehemently disagree with, but there are some points that, you know, I found out are incorrect or that I don't totally agree with now. And it's just sort of, I don't know, it made me value the podcast more in general because it's sort of like my opinion on this thing at this specific time. And I've always been sort of saying that context is super important to the way people see movies. And it's entirely true in listening back to some of these podcasts because, you know, some of my opinions have changed because the context in which those opinions would exist now is different.
You know?
And I still love some of the opinions we've had on this podcast. And those are the ones you're going to be hearing. And I mean, it's not like this is the only thing we agree with anymore. But, you know, it's a...
But things
these
change.
These are sort of our favorite things. Yeah, things change.
And people change.
Yeah. We're still recording in the same room. I don't think we haven't recorded the podcast in any other room. But,
No, but I mean, and that's something that we talk about, especially when we're looking at kind of older movies, is how well things hold up and how important it is, how important when you saw a movie or what state you saw a movie in and how much that affects your opinion of that movie.
Yeah. That's something I've been arguing for years, like since I was 18 working at a video store.
Yeah, and I think I got in arguments with people who didn't believe that, you know, they like this movie a lot because they saw it when they were young.
Yeah.
And how much that affects. So, yeah, with the clip show, I guess we're talking about some things that have changed even within the last year.
Yeah.
Our opinions on things have changed a lot.
But the things we're going to be playing for you are things we still agree with.
Yeah.
And, you know, points that we think are worth hearing again or hearing for the first time if you didn't listen to this podcast and are, for some reason, listening to this.
So. Just a good one to start on. We do activities on the show.
We do.
That's how you know it's a good show. Because there's activity.
My eyes lit up. I know this is a audio medium, but my eyes did light up.
We're primarily a movie podcast.
Yeah.
But sometimes we do some sports and television and pop culture.
Yep.
This is a television-related activity.
Okay, cool.
And it is a single question.
Okay.
Which three television shows were the top-rated show for their last season? What show went off the air the number one show?
Murder, She Wrote?
Nope.
Yeah. Friends?
Murder, She Wrote?
Murder, She Wrote was an extremely popular show when it went off the air. It's just that they weren't getting in the right demographic. They were getting old people.
Yeah. Who don't find things.
Friends?
Nope. You're close with Friends, though. Yeah. You're pretty close. That's the really obvious one that you're not getting it.
Oh, Seinfeld?
Yes. Mm. To me, that's the obvious one.
MASH?
Yeah. You know, Jerry Seinfeld was offered like $110 million to that last season, even before like DVD sales and stuff.
No, I didn't know that.
That's so much money.
Yeah, that's a lot. So Seinfeld, MASH, and I don't know, All in the Family.
No, even older. It's a show you know.
But I Love Lucy.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Do you remember when Seinfeld went off the air and everyone was like, they should just like start over. They should just start airing it from like number one.
And nope. I didn't.
Oh, really?
I didn't follow it enough at the time. I was in grade six.
So okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, with Seinfeld, I think a lot of shows I find like South Park and Family Guy, which are shows I know I watch more often than you do. When you go back, when you've seen the whole show and then you go back to like the first episode or the first season, they're usually pretty lackluster, I find. Do you find that too? I guess so. More comedy, where it's like in those first episodes, they're kind of just like laying down the basics.
Oh yeah, no comedy, definitely.
Yeah, I guess comedy more so because you know you're trying to get those very simple ideas that they're going to be repeating over and over, and it's like their most basic form, and they haven't expanded it in any interesting direction.
Yeah, because I mean, primarily, my favorite television shows are dramas. Let's say my three, you know, just off the top of my head, my three favorite shows are probably Friday Night Lights, The Wire, 6 Feet Under. The Wire is the only one of those three shows that I don't think, right off the top of my head, that first season isn't the best.
Yeah.
I think the Six Feet Under's first season is amazing and significantly better than the rest of the show. And 24, I feel this way as well. I think everybody should watch the first season of 24. After that, whatever. But I enjoyed it. I watched it to the end. But the first season is the only one that's really, really good. And sort of The Wire, I think you can make an argument for season 3 or 4. I mean, again, Friday Night Lights isn't necessarily my favorite season, I don't think. Because I think my favorite moments happen in like season 3 and season 4. But I think as a whole, season 1 is probably the best.
Okay. Yeah,
so I think that's a very comedy-specific thing.
Yeah, I guess because with comedy, you've got to... Yeah, as I said, kind of lay down those basics and then you can take it somewhere interesting.
Yeah. So let's hope we can be classified as a comedy podcast and that we're getting better.
Yeah. Although, when I watched like the first episode of Family Guy,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, Stewie's an evil genius trying to kill his mom.
Yeah.
Like, they did that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you realize it's so fundamental and that's how you're introduced to these characters. And, you know, it's like that. But then I find with dramas, the pilot episode is often one of the worst.
With dramas?
Yeah, because they're, and not even necessarily with dramas always, but them especially, I just find that there's so much work to be done in the first episode that you're setting up so much and you're not able to have fun with these characters yet, or not even fun in like a comical way, but really, you know, do everything that these characters are going to be capable of. You have to establish all these relationships and the setting and how everybody gets to it.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think comedy is much, much more difficult, and I mean
to be funny in a pilot.
Yeah and to, you know, make your show seem good in the pilot. Like, I don't like the Arrested Development pilot all that much. Love that show. I guess 30 Rock is the only comedy pilot that I really, really loved. I don't know, because like the shows that I mentioned, The Wire, the pilot's not very good, and it takes till you meet Omar in the either 4th or 6th episode. I can't remember, but I don't think it's the
definitely
5th.
Not the 5th.
Yeah. Friday Night Lights, from the opening 3-minute montage, I was totally hooked. That's a great pilot. The opening and closing 5 minutes of that episode is stellar. And I think 6 Feet Under really set it a really good tone. So I think I disagree. Like I didn't, the show I'm watching now, Breaking Bad, I didn't love that pilot. Like we were talking about this yesterday. It took me like 3 months to get through the first season of that show. And I've watched the second season this week. So
yeah. Well, no, I guess it was just kind of, I've been thinking about it because as you said, we look back through some of the old episodes to find some of our favorite points and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's interesting with podcasts because when you find a new one, I mean, you can keep up with the episodes as they come out, but then you kind of have this back catalog of things to listen to. Do you kind of start where you are and then work your way backwards to the beginning, or do you listen to the new ones and go 1, 2, 3, 4?
Well, it depends. Like, I really only, as far as podcasts I listen to constantly, I listen to one media news podcast, I listen to one sports podcast, and one comedy podcast, like WTF, Mark Maron. Going back through WTF isn't that big of a deal, like, because it's not really time sensitive.
Yeah.
Whereas the other podcasts, I haven't gone back through on the media at all. I just listen to it week to week.
And it's news, yeah.
Yeah. And another podcast, actually, I listen to, the Signal podcast. You know, it doesn't really matter when you're listening to that. Like, you know, they tailor the music to the time period that it's released in. But I still listen, you know, I'll listen to October and June, you know.
Yeah.
And the sports podcast, again, it's very, I only go back in that one for guests that I enjoyed. Like, I went back to hear a Steve Kerr one from 2 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, it's with WTF, it's funny because when you go really, really far back, it's a much different show. Like, he was coming off Air America and he still has like bits and he has segments and multiple,
I skip all of those,
guests and stuff. Yeah. And then he kind of just honed in on what people like, which was the interviews with the one comedian.
Yep.
And of course, 20 minutes of self-indulgent Mark Maron to kick off the episode.
You mean like this? You mean like what we're doing right now?
That's exactly it. It's funny,
guys. This is our most Mark Maron-esque podcast ever.
But I can't even enjoy it.
Again, the audio is peaked.
Great. Yeah, I mean, podcasts are interesting because it's a very new medium, but it's all mixed in with radio still, which is like the oldest modern medium, pretty much.
Yep.
And so you get all the benefits of, you know, being able to record an episode cheaply and distribute it and have it archived forever. But at the same time, it's still kind of in a radio format where it's time sensitive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are like, oh, happy new year. And you're listening to it 6 months later. It's, you know, entirely off. So it's just interesting that it's like a combination of some of the newest and oldest stuff.
Yeah. No, I agree. I love podcasts. I'm so happy they exist. not just for our reasons.
No.
I like that there is a way for me to get my opinions on film out there, but if I have to have this or, you know, other people's podcasts taken away from me, we'll never do the MacGuffin Men again.
Yeah. And three people would care.
Yeah. So I guess, we'll start by going back through, our old ideas. So first we've got, I guess we'll just start with the shitty one and go with the start talking about Twilight.
Start off with a bang. So if this is your first time listening to this show, lure you in for the long run with some Twilight.
I think it sort of sums up a lot of things about our more unserious podcast, and that, you know, we don't like these things, but we're still curious. But anyways, this is sort of my explanation for why we did a podcast on Twilight, and I wanted to do a podcast about Twilight. I didn't really know why I wanted to do a podcast about Twilight, but I did. And as you've been listening, you can kind of tell this isn't one of our best podcasts because we don't have as much to say about it, simply because we're not interested. But the thing is, like, yeah, exactly. Like, we're not interested in this type of thing. Like, neither of us is particularly interested in vampires.
No.
Neither of us is particularly interested in this type of, like, big romance type of thing, or the big teen sensations. Rarely am I actually really interested in them, but that's the thing. I want to be interested in them. I want to know why this big collection of people want to, or care so much about it without thinking about it, whatever. They just, these twihards that they're just like, I'm Team Jacob and that's it. And like, that's kind of what I think why I wanted to do this is because I'm kind of like a vampire for that. Like, I'm isolated from this and I just sort of want to know what that experience is like.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what this is. It's like,
and all the twihards are Bella and you just can't read their
exactly.
minds and figure out what
exactly.
it is.
I love them and I love what they do for culture, but I just can't figure out what they're thinking. And and it bothers me, and I always want to know, and I want to know why they're interested. And
so this is why you're like violently, hatefully in love with Twyla.
I think so. They're my best friends that I've never met, but it's, I don't know. It's just, I guess that pretty much explains why I'm interested in Twilight outside of the fact that I'm not interested in Twilight.
Yeah, you don't enjoy watching it.
No, right? I don't. And I hated New Moon when I was watching. There was one good scene one funny scene where she's like, I'm apart from Edward. And she's just like screaming in agony when she's lying in bed. She's like, like at the top of her lungs and like grabbing her stomach like she's been stabbed like 8 times. And her dad is just downstairs like, sitting there quietly like, oh, that's just Bella. She's just
a teenager.
She's just sad that Edward left. And, like, it's just like, yeah, I mean, I'm totally isolated from this type of thing. Like, the type of person that wants to like these things as much as they do. Like, I don't even have a young cousin or little sister that's really big into these things. But I still am interested in it. And it's just, I can't care about it. And... but I want to for some reason. I don't know. I feel like anything that's sort of a big cultural thing, I feel like I should be at least partially interested in, and I'm just not. I'm just sort of just letting it go.
Yeah,
and
not even to love it, but at least to get it.
Yeah. Well, and I think I get it. It's just that I can't even be interested enough to watch the whole series.
Or the whole second movie.
Yeah. No, that's kind of what I'm getting at. I don't know. Yeah. That's what's weird about Twilight to me is that I'm so curious in it, but I don't care about it at all.
So you're clearly... Team Edward.
I guess.
Because you're the most like Edward.
Yeah, well, who can keep up with Jacob's abs, man?
It's tough.
I'm not doing 2,000 sit-ups a day. You crazy?
How do you keep that 19-pack, Jacob? Now you stay so shredded, bro.
Wow, good point, Alex. I never thought of it that way.
Well, we can't even do that because some things are... like, we're not going to go in that order because it's like me, 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 and then you, you, you. You know, it doesn't really make sense, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know, who cares?
Okay, fine. Well, then we're just going to go with the order that James and I talked about via email. So it's just a list, like the order of it's... you're going to hear a lot of James for a while. You're going to hear a lot of me for a while. But thanks for complimenting my Twilight point. Would you like to hear one about how I feel about the ending of Close Encounters and what that says about Steven Spielberg's career?
Would I?
Yeah. All right. Let's check it out. Well, something I found interesting about Close Encounters is that alien abductions in general, like people that want to be abducted by aliens, it's sort of the quest for transcendence, right? These are people, Roy especially, who they're basically searching for something more than human. They want to be better than everybody else. They want to be, I don't know, I suppose it's sort of the quest for immortality. Like you're human, you know you're mortal. You don't know about these aliens. This is this unknown thing. So what I found interesting about Close Encounters is that I sort of took Roy as Steven Spielberg. And Spielberg's quest for transcendence is filmmaking. He's trying to make this movie that will be remembered for a long time. And I think we can really see this in how quickly he wanted to revise it and then how he wanted to revise it again. And I mean, he did revise E.T., but that was more of an anniversary thing. Well, the second revisal was an anniversary thing for Close Encounters. But the first revisal was just like, I want to do this. I'm not happy with it yet. I want to change how this is seen. And so what I take as Roy going to the spaceship is sort of Spielberg sort of offering up his best into that spaceship to be remembered so that when he dies, it's sort of like, I'll be remembered by my films.
Yeah.
And that totally plays into the quote he has later about if I was a dad when I made that movie, he wouldn't have left his kids, because he's sort of this quest for filmmaking transcendence is a young man's game. And we can see that in the way he chooses his movies now. He doesn't always, he's not one to shy away from doing The Terminal as much as he might have been in as a younger guy. Like, he was probably very much more concerned about his legacy, and that's why he started doing The Color Purple and stuff like that. And Schindler's List.
Yeah.
And as a father now, he wouldn't do that. He's not as concerned. And we can see this with great actors like Pacino and De Niro sort of not caring about their legacy anymore. They're just like, I just want to have fun, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the thing that really backs up my theory for Spielberg being Roy is that Francois Truffaut is in the movie.
Yeah.
Famous director of like the 400 Blows and a lot of other things, who never acted outside of his own movies in another director's movies.
Yeah.
Just this one movie for Steven Spielberg. And there's even a line at the very end where Francois Truffaut's character, Lacombe, I think, says to Roy, as Roy is about to be abducted, says, "I envy you," which is sort of like Truffaut never got the level of fame that Spielberg did. And Spielberg is sort of, not that Truffaut won't be remembered, but Truffaut will be remembered by a very specific type of person.
Yeah.
Like yourself and I. And
I mean, when he was still making movies in his prime, people knew right then and there that this was something big with Truffaut, and it did have an influence on the rest of film, but he wasn't popular all over the world.
Yeah.
So many more people know Spielberg's name than Truffaut.
Exactly.
Like, always will.
And yeah, and that's the thing is that, so Spielberg or Roy goes up in the ship, they sort of take off. It's the end of the movie. We see written and directed by Steven Spielberg. It's like, reminder, I made this thing. This is what I'm sending out to you. This is sort of my quest for, you know, to be remembered. And I think what the years following, the 33 odd years following, or 34 years following Close Encounters, is proven that as kind of narcissistic as that was, he was 100% correct. And Super 8 is probably the easiest way to sort of be like, really say that, yeah, he's sort of achieved this.
Yeah.
You know, he's achieved his goal. He's achieved transcendence. And when the people, the initial abductees come off the ship, like the people that got taken in 1945 in Close Encounters come off the ship, we hear someone say they haven't aged at all. So Spielberg will age as a mortal. He will not age as we remember him.
Yeah.
Our memory of him does not really age. His movies stay the same. We get old. These movies don't age, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's sort of,
if he's Neary who went up in those, in that ship, he's doing the same thing where he's kind of hoping that he gets kind of frozen in time, right? Where he's not going to age anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying about the quest for transcendence. The whole wanting to be abducted thing is the quest for immortality, and Spielberg has attained filmmaking immortality for sure.
Cool. Well, I think all of these throws are going to seem awkward now that I'm thinking about it, now that we're recording this.
Aliens are cool.
Right? I kind of remember what I said there. We also did a podcast that same summer about the differences between the whole Conan O'Brien and David Chappelle fiascos, how they existed 5 years apart. And
fiascos.
Oh, I kind of like that one. I'm kind of okay with that.
Good.
So yeah, this is sort of us discussing why we wanted to do the two things together as one podcast.
It's really good. When we first started talking about doing this podcast, I kind of wanted to do it as two podcasts because I thought Conan's whole debacle was enough of a story and that the Chappelle show thing was an interesting story. But you convinced me otherwise, because there is something to be said about the differences and similarities between the two, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was motivating you to want to do these ones together, which I do agree with you now is a good idea?
I think that, let's say we've got these two separate comedians, and ratings are probably actually kind of similar because being on a network and having an unpopular show is basically the same as being on Comedy Central and having a wildly popular show.
Which is about 2 million viewers.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, it's just these two comedians that are generally well-liked by the youth, essentially walking away from their show. Conan was sort of forced out and Chappelle was less or so forced out and just sort of left.
But Conan did have that 1205.
Exactly. He had that option.
Did walk away from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the big difference was Chappelle walked away, was it in 2004, 2005?
It would have been 05 because season 3 aired in 06, which was shot in 05.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so say Chappelle walked away in 05. Conan walked away at the beginning of 2010, right?
Yeah.
The big difference was there was no social media outcry or anything for Dave Chappelle. Like, that just wasn't popular or wasn't possible yet. Whereas Conan O'Brien, everybody knew what was going on with the I'm with Coco, Team Coco, whatever you want to call it. And that's sort of how Conan was able to sort of control the message and sort of build a sort of army of followers that would eventually go see him on tour and eventually support him on for his first week on TBS. I don't know what his ratings are anymore, but they were pretty good the first week. Whereas Dave Chappelle just sort of disappears and suddenly he's smoking crack. You know, like that's what it became.
Yeah.
Just because the huge difference in this five-year span. And I think it's fascinating for what it says about where media is, and that we're so much closer now to celebrities than we have been before.
Yeah.
And also how celebrities can sort of, like, even if you get screwed by a network, you can sort of flip it. And I mean, Conan's still worse off than he would have been staying on NBC, I think, both financially and status wise. But, you know, he took control and he's got a lot of creative control over at TBS. And I think Dave Chappelle is doing essentially the same thing in that he's doing exactly what he wants to do, which is not a lot. You know, it's just sort of, he's doing stand up and raising his kids. And yeah. I mean, I will always applaud someone who's smart enough to walk away when they're not comfortable, especially in something as the level of stardom that Chappelle had for a while. I'll always appreciate that. And I don't know, that's sort of why it's interesting to me.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It wasn't even just the public that kind of went nuts for Conan. You had all these comedians,
yeah,
all these, you know, other figures, television personalities, celebrities all taking a side on this. And I mean, it was more of a divisive issue one side or the other than Chappelle's show was. But even now, I couldn't find anybody talking about Chappelle's show. And now you just have so many people, so many ways to get your opinion across and have it known that you know where people stand on these issues. Whereas with Chappelle's show, it just kind of, he walked away. There wasn't a debate or controversy or public outcry. And then, you know, Newsweek and these other people just kind of filled in the gaps with whatever they wanted, essentially. Yeah.
Smoking crack, South Africa, mental health facility.
Yeah. But you said they're big with the young people too, right?
Yeah, yeah, both. I mean, I think if you look at Conan's main audience, they're in their 20s probably.
Yeah.
You know, like people our age. And Chappelle was very, I'm sure his audience was very, very much youth.
Yeah.
You know, it was a very youth-oriented show in general.
Oh, why do you think that's the case?
Well, it was fairly, I hate using the word edgy, but it was edgy for Dave Chappelle's show. Like, yeah, that was some, like, say something your parents would scoff at occasionally, whereas you think it's the funniest thing in the universe,
yeah,
just because your perception of what should and shouldn't be allowed on TV is different. And, you know, like that's sort of how it was for Chappelle's show. And Conan O'Brien, his whole thing is being very sort of high energy and stuff like that. Whereas, late show hosts before them haven't always been, they're sort of just sitting back cracking jokes, you know?
Yeah.
And
reading jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's sort of how Conan is. And also Conan is fairly youthful looking. That's part of it.
Yeah. Like a weird child doll.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's part of it as well, but mostly the high energy stuff.
Yeah.
And also same with the, like, masturbating bear and stuff like that, stuff that, say, Carson probably wouldn't have done, you know?
Yeah. I think that's safe to say.
Because he couldn't get away with it.
I didn't watch a lot of Johnny Carson, but I'm guessing he didn't have anything like that.
Yeah, when he put the cards up to his head, none of them had a picture of a masturbating bear on them.
Or a self-pleasuring panda.
Yeah. Masturbating animals at all.
Yeah, and I think the youth thing was a big part of it, and the way that the narrative kind of goes retrospectively, I touched on this before about people are saying Jay Leno was the mastermind behind all this, which we've kind of touched on isn't exactly the way things went.
No, God no.
But looking back on it, the narrative was like Conan was the young gun, kind of, you know, the ones that people liked, and the guy that people actually liked and, you know, worked hard and did his own stuff. And Leno was just kind of this old dude that old people in, like, the Midwest were watching, and those are the only people who really liked him. And
yeah,
he kind of controlled the whole thing. And
your coworkers like Conan, but your boss liked Leno.
Exactly. And the social media thing played right into that so well, right?
Yeah.
Conan
getting
all his fans through Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, Leno's Twitter has like 30,000 people or something, where Conan got 30,000 within like 3 hours of signing up to Twitter, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the social media plays a lot into the way that we look at that narrative now, as Conan kind of taking down the old guard and being the edgy again kind of youthful person. I mean, when he announced his Legally Prohibited from Being Funny on TV tour, he announced it initially through Twitter and Twitter only. and all the dates at the time sold out in 2 hours, which I think, even if you're not that big on Conan, if you want to be kind of, you know, proud of your young generation and all the kind of social media stuff that they're doing, but the figure you want to get behind someone who became so successful through these media, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was, I mean, awesome. I wanted to see Conan succeed in some way for the reasons that, you know, it's the man's beating him, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I always want to beat the man. You know, it's good to see him succeed however he has to use it, and social media worked for him, so that's wicked. One thing I wanted to sort of say is that we were talking about social media and how it sort of affected Conan, whereas, you know, it didn't exist for Chappelle. Mm-hmm. In the short term, that worked out far better for Chappelle, for Conan. And in the short term, it worked out terribly for Chappelle, or, I mean, he probably doesn't care anymore, but mm-hmm. I mean, the rumors that he's smoking crack, you know, whereas in the long term, that the social media and stuff for Chappelle, or, you know, as much media coverage as maybe it would have gotten now, in the long term, that lack of media coverage and social media is probably kind of what Chappelle was happy about. Because less people will recognize him because there was less coverage about this.
Yeah.
So I think he's probably happy that the story eventually just kind of, and I mean, not that Conan's story is still, you know, totally on everybody, you know, the forefront of everybody's mind or whatever.
No.
But I don't know. I think Chappelle has sort of faded into the distance, and that's exactly what he wanted. And it took a year of some, you know, some weird things in the media and stuff, but he got exactly what he wanted. Whereas Conan, I think he's kind of happy the way things worked out given the situation, but he's not getting what he wants.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a double-edged sword with Chappelle, because, and it's tough to say, because even before things started going poorly with season 3, as I said before, he wasn't big on being a star. Like, who knew if he would have even had a Twitter feed or something?
No, exactly.
Right? If he did, he would have been able to kind of control his own image a little bit and say, like, once that Newsweek report that came out said he was on crack, like, he would have said, nope, not.
Yep.
Like, here's a twit pic of me with my kids, you know?
The part of that is that he totally disappeared in that he didn't tell Neil Brennan, the co-creator of Chappelle's show,
where he was going. Writing
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, they co-wrote Half Baked together. He didn't tell him what was going on. He just left.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah. I absolutely see your point. I don't think Dave Chappelle has a Twitter feed. I haven't looked it up.
Yeah.
I would imagine he doesn't. But I feel like he would have said something had the Avenue been there.
Yeah, that's... But when I say it's a double-edged sword, he would have had more control of his image if he wanted it, which you can debate whether or not he would. But there probably just would have been more TMZ and more speculation and all these other negative things that he was running away from, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So it's tough to say.
But can you get much worse than smoke crack?
Yeah,
smoking
really?
Crack?
That's true.
two very interesting stories, and I would, you know, like, if we're ever sort of able to flip them and just see how things would have worked out, I would be very interested to see that.
Yeah.
But I'm not confident that technology will exist anytime soon to sort of move historical events around and see what would have happened with no consequences. But Dave Chappelle, do something, please. You're awesome. Yes. Conan, keep doing what you're apparently doing.
I've heard you're doing things.
I hear you're on a channel I don't watch, doing a format I don't care about. So, you know, more power to you. Speaking of pop culture figures that aren't really movie stars, although I guess this one kind of is, we also did a podcast on Eminem.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
He's a movie star.
He is of one movie.
Almost Jumper, too, though. For people who don't know, he was nearly the star of Jumper.
There's a difference between Doug Liman wanting him to be Jumper. Like, there's no guarantee he was offered Jumper and was like, what the fuck are you thinking, Doug Liman? You know? You want to give us an intro for this one?
I am a big Eminem fan.
Yes.
Unabashedly. Mm-hmm. And this is something I thought up all by myself. A lot of times I just read other people's opinions and distill it for the podcast.
Yeah.
This one was genuinely my idea.
Yeah, and I like this idea.
Yeah. And so this is about the significance of Eminem coming from Detroit. Yeah, and within 8 Mile, we do see the importance of Detroit.
Yep. I mean, the It's called 8 Mile.
It's called 8 Mile, which is an area of Detroit. Well,
8 Mile Road.
Street Detroit. Yeah, road in Detroit. I guess it only makes sense that the job he has is at an automotive plant.
Yep, that's true.
That's very, it's a very Detroit thing. It's mm-hmm. Motor City. That's kind of what made Detroit what it is now. And there is that part where they go and burn down that house.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you know, if this was in the different part of Detroit, then this house already would have been taken care of, or they wouldn't have let something like this happen, you know?
Yeah. Oh, Detroit is definitely more important to that movie than it is to Eminem's career, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do see kind of Detroit as a really good, I mean, even if Eminem did come from somewhere else, I think Detroit is a good fit for him for a lot of reasons, because it's not New York, it's not L.A., especially now, even more so than when 8 Mile was made. Detroit is a failure.
Yes.
Sorry, all Detroit listeners out there.
But they don't have the internet there. We're fine.
No, but it's such a disaster there. I was there a couple months ago, and it is, you know, terribly economically depressed. It's a very emotionally depressing place. And it's just failed. It seems like the thing that set it all off and made it really the city that it was the auto industry. And it's failed. And I think that kind of fits in well with a lot of things in Eminem's career and within Eminem's music. Like, it was, Detroit was kind of this promise of a better future. It was, you know, an American invented this automobile idea, and we tried to run a whole city on it, and it's failed. And now there's all these angry kids in it who grew up poor, who, you know, the city that, you know, was supposed to be there for them really didn't have a chance to support them. And I see kind of the same thing in prescription pills, which is a reoccurring theme in Eminem's music. Yeah. His mother abused pills, you know, pretty bad. She had a lot of mental problems, and prescription pills, he always says, made it worse, or was kind of the sole thing that was making her such an awful parent.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the same thing. It was this promise. It's like, you know, here's this American invention. Here are all these prescription pills. Your life's going to be better if you just take these. And it just got so much worse. Mm-hmm. It's not that it had a neutral or only barely positive effect. It had this huge negative effect. And then we see that later on with Eminem's music, as he later on in his albums, it's not the weed, it's not the alcohol, it's not the cocaine that ended up doing him in, even though he has tons of songs about doing
all those
ecstasy and mushrooms and LSD. That's not what did him in. It's this thing that you can buy over the counter, you know what I mean? Or, you know, get from your family doctor. And I just think that's a really great metaphor for kind of where Eminem's place in music is. And that's why he's kind of such an angry figure and kind of still fits within pop culture, where, you know, you can get cars and you can get prescription pills, but the long-term effects of it has just been so negative for so many people.
Yeah.
And same, you know, contemporary with the divorce rates. His parents were divorced or split up or however that went down. But he has a lot of music about how angry he is at his father for leaving him. And, you know, divorce is just one of those things where it became more and more popular and more regular in the United States, along with, you know, more automobiles, more prescription pills, things like that. And it really failed. And that's why he's so angry. So at the same time, he does have that place in pop culture because these are all normal, legal, socially acceptable things. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they've had such a negative effect on him. And, you know, he's clearly still made something of his life, but he doesn't sound very happy.
No, all of those points are very interesting, and I agree with pretty much everything. That's a great point, James. I know I said that before we threw to it, but now we need, like, welcome backs, and we've already discussed how these are going to be awkward.
Hip-hop.
And we also did a podcast about the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. And this is one, and these are points that, I mean, you don't have to have seen the movie to get. I mean, we're going to spoil the movie, but this movie is kind of impossible to spoil because I just said the title.
The title is the spoiler.
Yeah. James had some interesting things to say about, you know, what the movie says about the movie star, and also what it says about anonymity. So, Anonymity.
Another Eminem one?
No, not Eminem.
Okay.
Like people that are anonymous, like the Roland Emmerich movie about Shakespeare. That.
Gotcha. Just to go back to that idea about celebrity and Brad Pitt and Jesse James, Robert Ford, all that. Do you take any meaning from it being Robert Ford who kind of destroys Jesse James? Like this person who is so hungry for fame, kind of you know, destroy the most famous thing?
Mm-hmm. No, I've never really put that much thought into that, I suppose.
Okay, so, I mean, the last time I was watching this, and honestly, we talked a little bit about this, but the first couple of times I was really just totally entranced by this movie, and I just watched it as a movie, really didn't analyze it too much, didn't try to read too much into it, and it's still a good movie then. But with the reading to it, you kind of can get appreciated for, you know, kind of being a bit deeper. I mean, it's definitely a good character study, but I think you're right that there is more to it than that.
Character studies normally bore me. You know, like, yeah. I feel like if this fame stuff isn't in Jesse James, I get bored.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the term character study just kind of, it's like, I don't care.
Okay. There Will Be Blood's kind of a character study.
Yeah. And how much do I like There Will Be Blood? I think it's an interesting performance in an otherwise kind of not very good movie.
That's true. I forgot you aren't the biggest fan of that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so Robert Ford really, he looks up to Jesse's fame. I mean, even before he knows Jesse, he really likes Jesse. Doesn't really know who he is, but he likes who he believes Jesse is, right?
Yep.
So he's kind of working towards building up to be Jesse. I mean, there's that one line, do you want to be like me or do you want to be me, that Jesse says to Bob at one point. So yeah, he's really working towards being him. And as you stated before, as his fame grows, you can see how happy he is. There's that one point where the governor says, are you Robert Ford? And he's so happy that someone knows his name and someone recognizes him, right? And even after he shoots Jesse, when he hands in the telegraph to send to the governor to say that Jesse's dead, he says, you know, you might want to keep that. Like, it's an autograph. It's a piece of memorabilia from your now favorite celebrity or something, right?
Yep.
To me, I just think of... There's two things, really, about this. One is the death of the movie star, which we kind of touched on a little bit. But for a while, the last almost, I guess almost the entirety of the movie is you see Robert Ford wanting to be like Jesse James. And as he gets closer to him, he's kind of deconstructing him. And as you said, it becomes clearer and clearer that Jesse isn't this perfect, you know, mythological person, that he is just a human being with flaws and he mistreats people and he cracks and he does things that he wishes he didn't do later. To me, it kind of reminds me of the way that we're so close to celebrities now through, you know, like social media and Twitter and the paparazzi and all these tabloids. I mean, we get to see so much of them that we do see that they're just people now. And it sort of has taken away from this idea that stars are stars. They're kind of just other people who have a very public profession. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's good and healthy.
Yeah, and yeah, no, you're right. But in a way, I mean, it's really taking down this idea of celebrity. I mean, people still read these magazines and they still feel this weird connection with someone that they've never met. But it is breaking them down to be just people. And you know, we see more of their scandals. We see more pictures of them without makeup. We see, you know, their ugly breakups in the papers and stuff like that. And this has really led to, that's for sure. What I think you can make the argument for is that has led to the death of the movie star, where it used to be in the 40s, 50s, even 60s, if the number one star in Hollywood was in a movie, that movie was going to do well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that used to be a guarantee. You put Clark Gable in a movie, it doesn't matter what a bad movie it is, so many people are going to come out to see it. And that's really not the case anymore. I mean, we saw Larry Crown bomb with, you know, two of the biggest stars, two pretty much Hollywood icons at this point.
The two 90s stars, basically, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts couldn't get it. We talked about The Tourist, which didn't do well in the States. You're right, internationally, people went to see it. But yeah. Johnny Depp, Angelina Jolie, two huge stars again. No?
I don't think Johnny Depp is a big like star. Like, I've never understood the him as a movie star type of thing. And okay. Same with Angelina Jolie. But anyways.
Okay. Well, they're big celebrities, though.
Yes.
You can say that. Okay.
Absolutely.
So they're big celebrities. There's just not getting that dry anymore. It is so much less consistent. Almost everybody can be in a flop now. It's insane that Will Smith is making like almost consistently well-received movies. And that's kind of an exception.
Well, yeah, he is the last person left who guarantees a big opening weekend.
Yeah.
Even 7 Pounds kind of did. And that's why Men in Black, I think it comes out next summer. I'm really interested because all of the on-set reports and stuff like that, and it's just like the script is still being written and there's like 5 days left in production or something. Like, that movie's going to be shit. Like,
yeah.
all signs are pointing it to be like a terrible movie. And I'm really curious to see how that movie opens.
But I mean, I don't think the death of the movie star is a bad thing.
No, I don't think so either. I think it's
a healthy thing.
I think it's good that people are seeing movies that are good, not because someone that they recognize is in it. I just think that in the context of this movie, Robert Ford really is the fan. He mm-hmm. kind of stands in for the fan, for you know, people hungry to meet celebrities, to, you know, obsessed with star power. And as he gets closer to the celebrities and learns, not the celebrities, but gets closer to the celebrity, Jesse James, and starts to pick him apart and, you know, understands that he's just a normal, fallible human being, he's very unimpressed, and it ends up with him killing him. And in a way, we see, you know, fandom kill celebrity. The way that we need to know all these things about people, this obsession that we've had with celebrity has really diminished the power of celebrity, because now we just see people as we see celebrities as just people, and we see these actors as just, you know, another guy who happens to have a very public profession. And so I think of, you know, Robert Ford as fandom. I see Jesse James as celebrity, and in a way that this intense hunger for celebrity in a way has actually killed it.
Yeah, I can see that for sure.
One last thing that I have is just about kind of the Old West and the internet. I just want to connect those two things. I don't think that connection's been made too much. No?
Say connect again.
Connect?
Internet connection.
Oh. No pun intended, I guess. And I guess this can really apply to most Westerns, I find. It's just something about the Old West and... We have been, I mean, 2007, as you said, was a good year for Westerns.
Yeah, yeah. Good year for film, good year for Westerns.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of good Westerns got made. Several Westerns did get made that year, too, even some that we didn't mention. The kind of the early days of the internet in the Old West have a lot in common. I mean, there's a lot of anonymity. We see Jesse James for most of this movie, outside of a circle of friends, is known as Thomas Howard?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident.
Thomas Howard.
His first name's definitely Tom.
Yeah. Oh, his last name is definitely Howard, so case closed. He moves around. They say his family doesn't know why he moves so much. He is an outlaw. He has to be constantly on the run. He's always got people chasing him, so he's moving a lot. Anonymity was something that you really could get away with in the Old West. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could go to, you know, Calgary now and introduce yourself as something different, but eventually it's going to catch up to you when you start using credit cards and get a mortgage and buy a car and stuff like that. It's a lot harder to do that. Also just the lawlessness in the Old West. It's really weird for us to think, but there were certain towns and entire territories that really didn't have law. There wasn't a police force. It was really completely lawless. And to me, that just reminds me of the early days of the internet, where we are now, and how we're going to see that go away, the way that it went away in the Old West. Just crime is rampant on the internet now, the way mm-hmm. that we download things for free and steal things and copy things. And we're seeing that go away. And I'm not going to be remotely surprised in my lifetime when bootlegging things over the internet is a lot more rare. It's never going to go away the way that crime doesn't go away in the real world either. But, we're going to see less and less of it. And the way that the Old West died down was kind of the same thing. Crime just decreased and decreased. And then we have kind of a normal society. Same with anonymity on the internet. You know, when the internet came out, no one really knew who anybody was. Now, when kind of Facebook and things came around, there was a bit more of a push to actually be you. I mean, you can still make a fake Facebook profile, but anonymity is going down. I mean, there's still message boards and things like that, but it's very... You really are more of a person on the internet, an individual, than you used to be, just a series of different names doing different things.
And people are just more comfortable using their real name on the internet now.
Yeah, and one of the things that we saw from Facebook to Google+ is real names and, you know, like one account. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And that seems...
And Google shutting down accounts that don't use your real name.
Yeah, exactly. So we are kind of seeing this thing where anonymity is going away. It's more about being one person and owning up to your own identity. And, you know, just the anonymity and the crime and, you know, kind of the free reign that used to be in the Old West, the way that went away, we're going to see the same thing on the internet. And they're obviously two very different things, but it's just the way society always progresses, I find. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I agree. And I mean, we're starting to see things on the internet be regulated, or at least, you know, the beginnings of things stepping up. Like, is online poker kind of being sort of shut down a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because, absolutely.
Because online poker was, you know, by letter of the law, illegal.
Yeah.
But it was everywhere, you know?
And yeah. Is there a better, you know, say it again, connection between the Old West and the internet? I mean, exactly. Poker, right?
head to the online version of a saloon.
Yeah, exactly.
And, yeah, no, I mean, it's sort of starting there, and it's going to find its way to the rest of, you know, things are going to change, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just the way things go. But yeah, I agree. I agree with your point.
Go see this movie if you haven't.
Go see it. Download this movie. Download this movie if you haven't seen it before they shut down your opportunities.
Wow. Well, the internet is still the final crazy frontier of anonymity and lawbreaking.
Yeah, exactly. Nice talking about Brad Pitt there, James.
Thanks, man.
Who you love.
I do.
Yeah.
I want to touch his face.
I actually don't know how much. Well, I guess the movie star one, you probably talked about Brad Pitt. We're sounding so professional right now. Yeah, and we also.
Hey, it's a clip show, man.
Yeah.
Champagne's flowing.
Oh, man. Just streamers all day. Someone brought in some silly string during the last clip. Yeah, and we also did a podcast on John Hughes, sort of an auteur podcast of sorts, but just sort of focusing on. You know, we didn't watch Curly Sue because nobody wants to watch Curly Sue. But I think I actually used that joke in the podcast. Recycled material. And then I sort of had a theory as to what Ferris Bueller's girlfriend, Sloan, played by Mira Sara, represents.
Michael Sara.
Michael Sara wasn't born in 1986 or whatever this movie was made.
Close, though.
Yeah, oh, it's close. Okay. But Michael Sara is younger than me, which means he's younger than Ferris Bueller. Stay off the movie.
He looks like a dragon in the pilot of Arrested Development.
Okay.
Fun fact.
Tidbits. So yeah, here's my bit about what Sloane represents. In Pretty in Pink, Breakfast Club, and 16 Candles, he was sort of like giving us a look at teenage life. We're sort of seeing how he sees teenagers and that in turn, which by all accounts was how teenagers were at the time. And kind of still is how they are, at least to my recollection. And then, you know, he's sort of setting out all these sort of types of teenagers, particularly in the Breakfast Club. But it's all sort of, you know, it's fairly explicit, but there's never really, and there's some fourth wall breaking in Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles. But Ferris Bueller really takes it up a whole another level in that Ferris Bueller is often seen addressing the camera directly.
Yeah.
And Ferris Bueller is also sort of like this, a type of philosophical character. He's not, you know, he's not reading Descartes to us, you know, or anything, but he is spouting out life philosophies, most notably the one that is repeated and the one that everybody remembers and is probably in your high school yearbook somewhere, which is life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop, take a look around, you could miss it. Which, you know, I might not be getting word for word, but probably pretty close. And, that's sort of what we leave the movie on. And I sort of look at Ferris Bueller as, and since this is the last teen movie, that John Hughes would direct, he wrote Some Kind of Wonderful, but was also apparently very hands-off on that production. He just sort of wrote it and, would show up on set sometimes, but that was about it. And Ferris Bueller was the last time he would shoot inside of a high school or shoot a high school character. And it's sort of like he set out how we see these high school characters. And now he's telling them to sort of how to live their life from now on. You know, he's giving them suggestions as to how to go on, you know, like, I think he's sort of like, he knows he's not going to continue this on and like, he's got his foot out the door and who knows, maybe if Ducky ends up with Andy and Pretty in Pink, he never writes Some Kind of Wonderful, you know? And Ferris Bueller is very much about moving on. Like, it's all about having one last great time before you graduate. And, you know, what's a better time in the movies than Ferris Bueller? And then he sort of graduates from teen movies as Ferris, Cameron, and, well, not Sloane, she's a year younger, graduate from high school. And that's sort of why, what I really like about the movie and why I think it's so interesting is that Ferris, it seems totally in control at all times, but he's not. He's really worried about his future. And I think that's valid. You know, he's legitimately worried about him and Cameron no longer being friends, which I think is extremely realistic for a teen movie and really cool because, you know, how are you not worried about that, especially if you go to different colleges?
And that's why I sort of see the Sloane character, played by Mia Sara, as sort of more important than people generally give her credit. I think she's great in the movie. She's extremely beautiful and extremely graceful. But what she is the one thing that Ferris knows will happen. Throughout the movie, we get a couple references to him saying, "I'm going to marry you." And the last thing she says is, "He's going to marry me," which is like, she knows this is going to happen. They're going to be together. And what she is sort of like the embodiment of hope, you know, like she's not like this really fully formed character, but just in her, if only in her physical appearance and the way she sort of moves, like she is very graceful and she's got those Disney eyes. So she looks very hopeful at all times. And you can sort of see that in Andrew McCarthy's eyes a little bit with Andy ending up with him at the end of Pretty in Pink. But yeah, Mia Sara plays sort of the hope for the future. John Hughes hopes everything works out for all these characters. And this is the one thing that we know is going to be a constant in Ferris's life going on. And yeah, she represents hope and that she's so, you know, she looks so hopeful. And, you know, it's Hughes' sort of hope that his audience will continue on and enjoy their lives even without him.
Okay. Yeah. I know I saw an interview with Matthew Broderick kind of to one of the points you said where they asked him about the sequel and he said in some way there is no sequel to this movie because it's not just about Ferris. It's about that time in your life. It's about that last week before you leave school and like there is no sequel to that because that's one moment that just, I mean, you don't get to repeat that. That you're absolutely right. That is such an important part of the movie of just the time frame of it and how it's about one thing ending and a totally different thing starting. And yeah, as calm and cool as he is, you do see he is giving this concern to his future.
Isn't Sloane gorgeous? Yeah. I probably mentioned it in that clip, but I just want to talk about it again. She's so pretty.
Hughes sure nailed it.
I don't even... Maybe oh, you. You were trying to say you.
I should have had a word that started with S, but not... Sure, because that's a different sound.
Let's talk about something that wasn't awful, which are the Bourne movies.
Those are not awful at all.
we did...
Those are awfully good movies.
God, stop it. We did podcasts on the Bourne movies, and actually we're going to be rerunning one of those, the better part of that, in our 2 weeks off for Christmas, or whatever holiday you choose to celebrate. But yeah, we sort of looked at why Bourne is the left-wing action hero.
I know you're trying to sound inclusive there, but it just sounded really demeaning. Whatever fucking holiday you fucking celebrate.
Yes.
Bourne, left-wing action hero.
Yeah.
I like this podcast.
Yeah, it's a good podcast. We're going to rerun it. Yeah. We're going to rerun that and Eminem. We also like the Eminem podcast. But yeah, here's us talking about Bourne as the left-wing action hero.
You mentioned Bourne as being, what do you call him, the left-wing superhero?
The left-wing action hero. And towards the end of the Bourne Supremacy, the commentary track on the DVD, Paul Greengrass talks about how after the end of the car crash or car chase, he basically pushes Kirill into the wall in his Range Rover, and there's like those two tunnels, and there's the dark tunnel and there's the light tunnel, and Bourne goes up the light tunnel. It's sort of like him choosing like the better way as opposed to killing Kirill. And that's where Greengrass is like, yeah, he's sort of the left wing, I don't remember the exact phrase he uses, but it's the left wing superhero or action hero or liberal.
Probably action hero. Or,
yeah, exactly. It makes more sense. And then, yeah, and he's sort of like choosing the right way, choosing hope and all these things. And at the end of the third movie in the commentary track, Greengrass is talking about basically Bourne lying motionless in the water. He's like, yeah, he was always going to live. Like, he is a symbol of hope, you know? Bourne is a symbol of hope, and the Bourne movies are a symbol of hope for the Hollywood blockbuster, essentially, to me. And that's why, like, you know, in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense for Bourne to have lived at the end of Bourne Ultimatum. Like, I didn't think about these things at the time, but he had to live for, like, hope to live,
I think especially then, while the Bush administration was still continuing, you would need to, if he's going to be your liberal hero, it would have been, I think, quite a bummer for him to.
Oh, yeah. I have not
survived that, you know?
So, I don't know.
Yeah, so, I mean, when we talk about the characteristics of, you know, a Bourne kind of hero, we've already touched on he's apologetic, you know? He's pretty vulnerable. He eats, he gets injured, he has to sleep, and all these kinds of things. He gets caught off guard, things like that. You know, he avoids killing, as we said, when he can. He's not very sure what he's doing. I mean, when you look at it as a hero for our country, it seems to point to a very remorseful, apologetic confused nation at this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what do you think that's, where do they get that national identity from? What's
the people that are in the dark, essentially, yeah. I would think, in that the common person, because Bourne at the very beginning of the first movie is totally in the dark. And by the end of the third movie, they're, you know, just most people know that they're in the dark, like in real life. I mean, like by this point, we knew a lot more about the Iraq war and all that stuff. And,
yeah. I think it was more about how it was handled. I think it was a nation of people who after 9/11 said, like, you know, we have to do something about this. It's unacceptable. We have to do whatever it takes. Let's go get somebody for this. You know, even if we don't fully understand what happened, why it happened to us, who really did it. People, just after 9/11, they needed something. Like, they needed an invasion of a country, as bad as that sounds. And I think kind of the last...
And now, if there was ever a time when the majority of the country is going to be okay with it, it was, like, right after 9/11.
Yeah, exactly. And I think as... The apologetic side of it and the remorseful side of Jason Bourne is kind of pointing to this, a country that feels bad about probably how they overreacted and how they kind of let their government kind of go after the wrong people and do all these kind of roll back, you know, war crime laws and things like this and do all these things that America used to think it was better than. Mm-hmm. And now it's doing all these things to other people. And I think that's kind of where we get that apologetic side from. And, you know, they say there's that one point where Bourne finally gets to talk to, you know, his maker there, and he says, why did you choose me? And he says, we didn't choose you, you chose us.
Yeah,
you know, it's a democratic government, you know. Yep. you knew what Bush was doing after his first term. Like, you elected him again because this is what you really wanted. Like, you needed someone to hang for this, and, you know, he was fighting for you for that. And that's what I see every time when I hear that line, for sure.
Yeah, no, I've never thought about that, but that's, yeah, absolutely, and almost certainly is how they intended it.
Cool. Now I'm just as hyped up as watching that Bourne-Desch fight. Like, I just want to hit you in the face with a book.
I'm so glad Jason Bourne came to our party right now.
Oh, yeah, you guys missed him.
He had to go before.
He does things very quickly, and oddly, he moves in jump cuts. It's kind of crazy. Like, he doesn't walk, he jump cuts.
He got self-conscious because we were listening to the podcast about him.
Yeah. So he had to jump cut his way out of the room.
Yeah. And he never smiled the whole time he was there.
And we also did a podcast, probably our closest to this podcast. We did sort of a questions podcast where we just sort of talked about whatever the listener sent us, back in the golden age when listeners sent us emails more than once every 2 months. We're not bitter.
That
brings
me back.
But yeah, and this is sort of something that we discussed. And I think this is something that really, really extends to pretty much all of our podcasts, in that we kind of have different philosophies and how we go to the movies. And I thought this was sort of an interesting discussion. I still staunchly disagree with your stance on going to the movies, but, you know, go to the movies. Here's our discussion. Okay. Now, just to explain something quickly to our listeners, James and I have sort of different styles when it comes to going to the movies, in that I rush there because I want to see things when they're first released, just because I'm kind of obsessive like that, whereas James tends to sort of leave things, just see them whenever, maybe years down the road, even though he'll want to see them when they initially come out, he just won't. So my question to you, James, is do you feel that your tendency to not see movies immediately upon their release hurts your perception of that movie? Like, when you do eventually see The Social Network or Black Swan, like 4 years from now, don't you think the amount of positive opinions you've heard about it causes you to compare the movie to those reviews?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it, it doesn't hurt my perception of the movie. It definitely alters it. I don't think it necessarily hurts it. I don't think knowing how people perceive it will make me like it more or less, but it definitely changes how I experience it because I have... You know, I'm going into a certain expectations, or just knowing how people feel about it, I'm going to come to expect one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I always try to, like, you know, I don't read reviews because I'm just trying to avoid basically finding out anything about most movies, you know?
Yeah.
Just because, I don't know, I'm weird, I don't get it. I don't want to know things about a movie before I see it.
That's fine. I don't like reading reviews of movies I'm about to see, that's for sure. But
yeah.
Just, you know, waiting a couple of years to see a movie, especially big ones like Social Network, Black Swan, like, they were so popular, Social Network more, so I just know a lot about these movies, but it also gives you a bit of perspective on it, too, and I think that when you know how it was perceived, when you know what Academy Awards it won, when you know what it went on to do for these people's careers, when you do watch those movies, you get to analyze both the movie itself and the reaction that people had to it. It's like when you watch, you know, Wizard of Oz, you know, we weren't alive when it came out or anything like that, but with all this build up to it, you can say, you can look at, you know, what caused it to be so popular, and, you know, you, after you know what happened to everybody, well, maybe The Wizard of Oz is the best example, yeah. But
once you know what happened to Judy Garland,
yeah, and Toto, it just affects, you know, you can look at it culturally, you can look at people's reactions and say, and you can learn things about the culture at the time that that movie was released, and, you know, the way people felt about it just by looking at how it's now, how it is in the narrative of cinema and things like that.
Okay. It's not like you can't get that if you see it when it initially comes out and then think about it a few years later.
That's true. But once you've seen a movie, your opinions, like your initial opinions of it, are going to stick with you forever. Not to say that a movie you liked when you were 10, you're going to necessarily like as much or in the same way when you're 50. But once you've seen it, you have that impression of it, and it will stick with you.
Okay.
I definitely think there's ups and downs of both.
My main argument is that you're far more, let's say you don't see Black Swan or Social Network for 5 years, you're far less likely to enjoy the movie than had you seen it in 2010, for both examples, because the Social Network is so very, it was like, I don't know, it feels like a sort of a summary of culture in the last 5 years, and Black Swan, just quite simply, I don't think will age particularly well. It's just sort of a thing that if you saw it when it initially came out, you probably liked it. But very few people are going to be talking about Black Swan in like 5 years. But Social Network, it's, I don't know, it's so very rooted in this time. And I feel like the perception of seeing it 5 years from now is totally different from, and not necessarily positively. Like, I feel like that movie will always be sort of a time capsule. Whereas
even you saying though, that it's like, it's a time capsule of, you know, or it's a summary of what's been, you know, that time or the couple of years leading up to it, you're not going to get the same, you're right, you're not going to get the same experience seeing it 5 years later. But if you do see something 5 years later, you can look at it as, how did we see ourselves at that time? And you're right, if you do see it then and you watch it again 5 years later, you could do the same thing. But I think when you do see it the first time, it kind of becomes, you kind of internalize it a bit, and you think of that movie to be very accurate of how we did see ourselves at the time, and that being a proper understanding of it. Whereas if you see it 5 years later without having seen it right when it came out, you could more easily say, like, they got it wrong.
Yeah, or absolutely.
Something like that.
Whereas, again, going to The Social Network, and it's, like, it sounds like The Social Network is my favorite movie of all time, which is not.
No.
But I'm just using it as an arguing point. Almost everybody that has seen that movie, that I've talked to at least, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and, me too.
Well, it's a good movie. It's totally about a culture that pretty much everybody experiences in North America. And it's very entertaining. Like, it's very fat. Like, that David Fincher didn't win Best Director is ridiculous, because that movie was so alive, it had a pulse, you know? Like, it's just so entertaining, but also really good. It's like Toy Story. Everybody's really passionate about Toy Story that you talk to.
Yeah.
Because not only is it very good and sort of resonates emotionally, and you can sort of see reflections of it. It's more of an emotional thing in Toy Story than it is in Social Network. Social Network's more of a cultural thing. I don't know. People see something interesting in it that is also super entertaining.
Yeah, it's just usually with a movie that is that big or that popular or that successful, you always just get detractors who say, it was okay, not that great, like, really overrated, or...
I love talking to those people. I love arguing with them.
I know, and a lot of people, I think, are just... I'm sure a lot of them do have legitimate, you know, tastes that just don't agree with that, but I think a lot of that is people wanting to be contrarian, or... maybe not even going to that point, but just it being, you know, you hearing so much about it that it just gets built up a lot, and you see it and you're underwhelmed or disappointed. That's... But I've heard so little of that with The Social Network, like even less than other movies where people, where it's like 98% say this, but 2% say this. It's like 99.999 with Social Network. And not, maybe not people are saying, film of the year, like best movie ever, but people are like, yeah, that was a really good movie. Like that was thoroughly entertaining and that was good.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess we're not going to solve it just because we just have totally different philosophies of movie going in that I feel very much like I want to see things almost immediately, like within the first couple weeks, just because I want to see if something's interesting or something looks interesting to me, I'm going to see it as soon as I can.
Yeah.
And just because, I don't know, I've seen so many movies, like I need something new, you know, I need to keep going.
And I'm not at the point where, I mean, all the points that I've said here, I don't believe them so much that I intentionally wait to see movies.
Yeah.
It's not like I want to give Social Network 5 years so I can have that distance from
it. You've got to let it age like a delicious wine.
Yeah. I do think that distance from it and that step back can be very interesting and very enlightening to the culture that it was released into, but it's not something that I feel necessarily makes a film better or lets you enjoy life more by waiting 5 years to see it. It's just something that has happened and I've noticed, and it can be kind of cool sometimes.
Yeah. I think as a whole, and I don't know if you disagree with this, but, as a percentage, I think the number of movies you would like less, waiting, is much higher than the number of movies you would like more.
Okay.
Is essentially my point. I feel like, and also because I see these movies in the theater, I think that sort of increases the enjoyment level for me because
absolutely.
I like everything more in the theater, which is why I see everything in the theater.
Yeah.
I guess I just want to enjoy as many movies that I watch as possible, and seeing them as quickly as possible is sort of how I'd manage to do that.
And you know what, Alex?
What?
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, there's not. I mean, we just disagree.
I don't disagree that that's a good idea.
Yeah, fair enough.
But just agree to slightly disagree on this one.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to our 50th episode. If you are still listening, you probably didn't find it masturbatory enough that you had to turn it off.
Or you masturbated to it.
Wow. You probably didn't do that. So thank you for listening. I mentioned earlier in the podcast, we're going to take, I believe 2 weeks off. We're going to rerun the M&M and, the Bourne podcasts. Mm. And, we should be back on January 5th. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but we're going to talk about something.
And if you want 50 more episodes, you can email us and make us feel like somebody listens to this.
Yeah. TheMacGuffinMen@gmail.com. And I mean, iTunes only stores, our 5 latest episodes online. But, if you've missed any, feel free to go to the website and you can download them all in MP3 format, themacguffinmen.com. And you can also read an article or two while you're there.
Or like 100.
Yeah, read them all. We've written some good things and we've written some bad things. You be the judge. Read them all and tell us what's good and what's bad. So thank you for listening to at least one episode of The MacGuffin Man. If you listen to all 50, I think you deserve a cookie. I can't afford to buy you that cookie, but...
There's tons at the party, though.
Yeah, you should be here. I think some of the cookies got streamers on them, though, so just don't eat the cookies with icing. Nobody's at the party. It's just for us. And Bourne left already.
And took most of the cookies.
That's so Jay. thank you for listening, and hopefully you continue to listen. We're the MacGuffin Men, taking 2 weeks off. Be on the 5th.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Mark Wahlberg. Not you, not you, and not you, Mark Wahlberg. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.